Okay, we're going to go ahead and get started now with the second panel of our speakers today. I'm delighted to welcome two people that I've been fortunate enough to work closely with over the last number of years. Dr. Emily Pine is the founding director of the Irish Memory Studies Network and the author of The Politics of Memory, published in 2010. On a very influential text in Irish memory studies, and she's also the author of the forthcoming The Memory Marketplace. Emily has been a Fulbright Scholar and has been the recipient of several Irish Research Council awards, including for her current project, a two-year New Horizons project, Industrial Memories, a digital one based on the Ryan Report. Emily's work on Irish theatre is also well known, and she has served to my... I have to mention this because I remain so impressed by this, because she went to, I don't even know, it was like 400 plays in one year. She also served as the Irish Times Theatre Awards judge, which is just extraordinary. And she's also the assistant editor of the Irish University Review. Dr. Sinead Kennedy has taught here in the English department since 2008 and is the coordinator of the MA in Gender and Sexuality in Writing and Culture. She co-edited with Aideen Quilty and Catherine Conlon the Abortion Papers, Ireland, Volume 2, which was recently launched with great fanfare, and is currently finishing a book on Marxism, feminism, and the neoliberal state. She's been active in abortion politics for many years and is secretary of the Coalition to Repeal the Eighth Amendment. Her activism puts most of the rest of us to shame, particularly me, since she manages to combine it with incredible dedication to her students and the production of important scholarly work. And I'm honored to introduce both Sinead and Emily as colleagues and friends.
Thank you, Una. I am going to... Did I do this? Bingo. Brilliant. I'm also going to pass out a handout that I have, which doesn't really relate to the talk, but just is some information on the Memory Studies Network that Una referred to, because we have done talks on gender and commemoration, and just so people know that, you know, there are other resources that are already out there. Today I'm going to talk about gender and the memory marketplace. Since we're all here as part of a series of talks today on commemoration, I think we can probably all accept that commemoration is an important part of our culture, and one that we don't want to do away with. If we here in this room accept that commemoration is important, then perhaps we need to ask a little more about why we think so. And forgive me if some of this seems relatively straightforward, but sometimes it's good to go back to first principles. And also forgive me for repeating any material. But again, sometimes these ideas and questions are worth restating. There are several strands to any act of commemoration, and in no particular order. Via commemoration, communities recognise watershed moments, both positive and negative. Recalling the past gives a community a sense of continuity and cohesiveness as a social group. Remembering the past creates a commemorative parallel with the present, so that communities can measure both the similarities and differences between then and now. Commemoration can provide a platform on which to build a future agenda. So we want to be less like that, or we want to be more like that. It's also worth saying that there are certain social rules governing commemoration, and that one is that being seen to remember is imperative. So here's an example of being seen to remember from 2 years ago at work, a year and a bit ago, actually. This is obviously important when it comes to national commemorations or collective memory. I've chosen this image in particular here to show the Irish ambassador to the UK laying a laurel wreath at the London Cenotaph in 2014 for Remembrance Sunday, the first time since 1946 that a representative from Ireland had been invited to participate in a wreath-laying ceremony in London. So the ceremony thus marks inclusion and difference. You'll notice that he's putting down a ceremony of laurels, not of poppies. What we see acted out here is a public performance of what we might call good memory, which fulfills both the social duty to remember and a political gesture of reconciliation through shared remembering, something Michael Rothberg might call multidirectional memory, and I'll come back to Rothberg. The political dimension of this performance indicates how commemoration is only partly about marking an important past event, as it's also inevitably about projecting an image of those who are doing the commemorating in the present. As Roisin and Mary have said already this morning, it's about now. With that in mind, I'd like today to look at this year's commemorations of 1916, and in particular the issue of gender provoked by the Abbey Theatre's commemorative programme. And just saying that, you know where I'm going. Okay, so this is Waking the Nation, world premieres to reflect Ireland today, new interpretations of some of the best plays of the last 100 years, extensive Irish and international touring, symposium, which is happening this week, in fact, on the challenges of commemoration and igniting a love of theatre in the next generation of theatre goers. So really, you see very explicitly there the tension or the relationship that is being created between then and now, from the past and Ireland of today. Yet in a year in which the Abbey will produce 10 plays, only two of them are by women. This is the Fiacla MacNeil's press release to commemorate and acknowledge the major historical events of 1916. The Abbey Theatre extended an invitation to artists and audiences to reflect on our past, the Ireland of today and of the future. We are proud to be part of the Ireland 2016 Centenary Programme with Waking the Nation, a season featuring an exciting roll call of new Irish voices alongside major revivals of some of the great plays from the Abbey Theatre repertoire. And it appears to be relatively gender neutral from the beginning, artists and audiences, until you get to the end where MacNeil only name checks three male playwrights. Most of the 10 plays are thus by men, and plays by men predominantly focus on male-dominated storylines. In fact, Frank McGuinness, his play is all male. And so the majority of the actors will also be male, just as the majority of the directors and the producers are male. So it's much more extensive than simply the gender or sex of the playwright. So when the Abbey says that these fresh and provocative Irish voices will reflect on the legacy of the 1916 Rising, it's mostly male voices and reflections that are going to be heard. There is nothing new here in that this is actually normal practice for the Abbey Theatre, which almost any year produces maximum of two women playwrights per year. And yet this is the year there has been a backlash with Waking the Feminists, which Una talked about in her introduction. As Leanne Bell, who's one of the kind of founding organisers of WTF, wrote, Irish theatre abounds with Irish women, unlike the Abbey's programme. So the backlash has been significant, and it has produced the Waking the Feminists movement, which galvanised people working in theatre in Ireland to demand gender equality on the national stage. There's a joke that they hosted the Waking the Feminists meeting in the Abbey itself, and it was the first time the Abbey had sold out in under 4 minutes in a long time. The international reach of this movement has also been, I love this photo of Meryl Streep, who stands with women in Irish theatre. Waking the Feminists has clearly struck a chord, as we can see from these photos, and has brought with it a huge amount of anger and energy, positive energy as well as kind of, you know, angry energy. This anger has long been repressed and is as much about the long-standing inequality in both the arts and society as it is about 1916. Though this is not new, I think that the explosion of energy happened now because of the perceived social and cultural importance of commemoration. And because commemoration is not just about the past, but about the present. So when Fiacla MacNeil tweeted, them's the breaks, in response to objections to the Abbey's programme, his blithe lack of concern, I mean, you couldn't make it up, really, his blithe lack of concern suggested that the 2016 programme represented something deeply wrong in Irish society now and not 1916. The Abbey is not alone, of course, in projecting a male-dominated image of Ireland then and now, as we can see if we look at the Decade of Centenaries website, exclusively male-dominated. The Irish Independent have a series of supplements to commemorate the 16. I haven't seen a single one of these supplements with a woman on the cover yet, although, you know, I love being contradicted. And in fact, it's actually too easy to play the game of spot the woman. Whether we're looking at commemoration or other cultural arenas such as sport, Maria Sharapova, tiny down there. And this is both visible and invisible. So obviously we have the images of men, but we also have the list of sporting events. And to the right, all but one of them is a male sport. Or politics. As Senator Ivana Bacik pointed out at the Waking the Feminists meeting, the disparity of male versus female representation in commemorative culture is not, in fact, an anomaly, but reflects structural inequality and discrimination occurring in many arenas of Irish life. At this point, we might add that the Abbey programme is predominantly, if not exclusively, white, though it's interesting that it is also predominantly focused on working class settings, though we might argue that the audience at the Abbey is not predominantly working class. Batchik's point is compelling because it suggests that critics should not separate off culture or commemoration from other aspects of society. Indeed, viewed alongside Batchik's comments, we can argue that the primary reason for some memories having status is because they belong to or express the values of a social group with social status, while memories belonging to a subordinate group have an equally subordinate status. And in this case, amazingly to me, women are that subordinate group. It always seems when you have, Manals talking about how can we include women, that in the 21st century that's an incredibly fatuous question. But I think it's also more complex than simply the idea that men hold more power than women in the public sphere and so are disproportionately represented in cultural and commemorative portrayals. In wanting to find a framework for thinking about cultural memory in general, and in this case the issue of gender and commemoration, I think it's helpful to perceive memory as a cultural product that circulates in a marketplace. Thus, the underrepresentation of women in the Abbey programme is due to a perception that there is no market for women's history. And that's why the comparison exists with sport. Women's sports are not shown on primetime because the majority of primetime viewers of sports programmes are men and they are more interested in men's games. Perceptions that women's sports or histories are less exciting or less intense, and this comes back to the question of were women actually combatants. The perception that women's history is less exciting or less intense are very much governed by gender stereotypes of women as passive, domestic, and physically weak, and by demand for particular cultural products based on those stereotypes. This is audience-led demand as much as it is programmer-led demand. In my secondary school, and this is where I give my personal example, in the mid-1990s, for example, male pupils in my year received extra games lessons, while female pupils were given what were called lessons in living, which included lessons on personal hygiene, putting on makeup, and the importance of using hand cream. We did classes entitled How to Be Nice to People. The same lessons were not imparted to the male pupils during their extra games sessions. And I know that because I had male friends, because girls and boys at that age, when you're 13, know each other. It's really hard to fight these ingrained, long-standing and long-cherished cultural assumptions, and 1995 is not that long ago. And the market, rather than challenging them, consistently exploits consumers based on the understanding that consumers accept and actually want these stereotypes. If we look at product marketing, one of the most successful strategies is market segmentation. So here we see this idea of market segmentation, which is basically the idea that by identifying different demographics, you can market your products to different segments. And whether that's based on age, gender, income, life cycle, lots of other factors. But here what we see is that gender is only one of the demographic features. In the case of commemoration, there are obviously other major factors, from the large market segment of the national audience to whom national commemorations are sold, to local audiences who are more interested in local events or different age groups. So you might imagine that, say, the Presbyterian Church's 1916 conference in Belfast, which is happening this weekend, might be slightly different from the focus in the National Library or the Abbey Theatre, which are also having commemoration events this weekend. But back to gender. With the slow but increasing emergence of women's history, the marketplace actually is shifting to recognise that there might, after all, be a market for cultural products primarily focused on women. So let's take, for example, the restoration of Richmond Barracks, which Mary has already talked about today, in Inchicore, where over 3,000 1916 rebels, both men and women, were held. Richmond Barracks is currently being restored and will have a new exhibition centre aimed at bringing what it calls untold stories to public attention. On its current website, this centre seems preoccupied with two narratives in particular. So this is the history tab. If you click on history, this is what you get. This is a male-dominated narrative. It doesn't name a single woman, but name checks the seven signatories of the proclamation alongside Michael Collins, Eamon de Valera, Arthur Griffith and William T. Cosgrave. However, as we have heard, the Barracks also have their exhibition on women and life, and this is a fabulous photo. I love that they're all grinning. And that this project, again, as Mary has discussed, is collecting further material, thereby importantly consolidating a history that has been dispersed and hidden, and so under-researched and under-known about. So you can argue that if audiences don't know the material are there, they can't ask for it. If we look at a different war, we can see a similar focus on women's history on the Europeana site. This is the site which brings together museum collections from all over Europe. It's really interesting, actually, if you're interested in looking at cultural studies across Europe. And this is the First World War. As you can see here, there are seven subject areas that you can use to browse the First World War collection. And again, the fact that there's a separate tab for women's history indicates an interest in specifically female-focused information and history. Of course, we might also argue that some of the other six subject areas might reasonably include women, for example, propaganda and remembrance, but that they implicitly don't, given the separate subject label for women at the bottom, and I think it's indicative that women label comes last in the list. The Europeana site and Richmond Barracks are two examples where we can argue that an exclusive focus on women generates a much-needed resource which aims to correct the absence of women from other histories. Indeed, I'm involved in a project myself this year. 1916 Home 2016 is a two-week festival of performing arts in October, happening in Ireland, Canada, the US, the UK, and being coordinated by UCD and NUI Galway with a conference in UCD at the end of October. This project focuses on women's history since 1916, and in particular the history of the Magdalen Laundries. Again, we hope to raise the visibility of the structural inequality of Irish society and culture through commemoration, and through our focus on how women have not just been excluded from mainstream history, but have a history of being excluded from society and basic human rights. However, the sticking point here is, as many people have already pointed out, the simultaneous result of projects such as these is to ghettoise or separate off women's history and to assert its difference from the normative mainstream, which remains implicitly masculine. Underlining this, I think, is my ambivalence about the Richmond Barracks quilt project, which during our discussion I thought that the qualitative reasons coming out for that were fascinating. I actually go to quilt museums in other countries, so I'm into quilting. But I still think that on its first appearance, its highly visible nature still has, this is what I'm ambivalent about, it still identifies women's history with feminine domestic sphere and with kind of soft arts. So we could put that out there for further discussion maybe. In approaching memory as singular, so women's history rather than history, rather than shared, these new memory resources do not correct the market bias, but are rather in line with and indeed a further development of current market practices of segmentation. Why does the market behave in this way? Why does the market not simply, in reaction to audience demand, address the inequality within the main narrative and ensure that in future it is balanced? Well, one way of explaining this is the marketing term, I'm having great fun reading marketing books, is the marketing term gender contamination. This term is used by advertisers to describe what happens when a product is so closely associated with one gender that the other refuses to buy it. Let's use Dove Cosmetics as an example. By recognizing that Dove, this is the first version, the upper left-hand corner, by recognizing the gender contamination of Dove's product line, which looks too feminine, right? Apparently the Dove in particular, too feminine, and the italicized writing, also a big no. And by changing the product to grey, much squarer bottles, putting men in capital letters on the product, and by segmenting the market in this way and creating products to fit it, i.e. by creating a separate Dove for Men range, Dove grew sales in less than a year by over $150 million. So segmentation equals profit. Now, this is a bit of a schematic comparison, because while men might not buy Dove shower gels aimed at women, plenty of, and also the female shower gels are cheaper, or sorry, are more expensive than the male shower gels. And plenty of men are interested in women's history and vice versa. But it does suggest something about how the marketers perceive the market and how they create cultural products in line with those perceptions. Indeed, a few years ago, to give another Abbey Theatre example, in 2013, the National Theatre made a concerted attempt to programme women's writing. This is largely led by their now no longer their literary director, Aideen Howard. In particular, her quest was to put a female playwright on the main stage, and they commissioned Elaine Murphy's play, Shush. In marketing Elaine Murphy's Shush, however, it's based on someone's birthday, hence the picture of the party, but she is at retirement age, so why she's being illustrated in a little girl way, I'm not quite sure. In marketing Elaine Murphy's Shush, however, the Abbey illustrated quite clearly who it thought the audience to women's writing would be, and in particular this play, since it was an all-female show. It wasn't a very strong production, and word of mouth, which is what really fills theatres, was poor. The Abbey mounted a strong marketing campaign, including a promotion that saw Cleary's department store offering a free makeover to anyone with a ticket. In addition, the radio ads suggested that women come to the show while their men were watching the football. In fact, they said, "Don't stay at home being a football widow. Get out of the house and come to the theatre." Okay, in contrast to Shush, the two all-male plays, which is again another example of the gender ghetto that happens a lot, right? I don't think men want to be in all-male environments. I don't think it's positive for male history either. In contrast, the two male shows that year were marketed very differently as kind of full of action, adventure, and compellingly interesting in their own right. If we want to stop segmentation and the idea that gender is a determining factor in whether an audience will buy your product or not, then we need to think about multidirectional memory. Though I don't think it's completely successful, and again, that's something we could talk about, RTE's Rebellion is an interesting case here because it frames the history of 1916 through the device of three female friends and the different directions their lives took in the Rising. And as Roisin mentioned earlier, what's striking here is the way that the drama is not being marketed as of particular interest only to women. And indeed that it's written by a man, Colin Teevan. The drama implies that through understanding women's experience of 1916, and there are male characters, two men are brothers on the poster, a contemporary audience will understand the experience of 1916 as lived by both genders. So there isn't, I think, even though I think in particular Colin Teevan's script isn't brilliant, I don't think it's entirely successful. What it is successful at doing is not saying that this was just a woman's experience. This is 1916 as RTE is presenting it. This chimes with Michael Rothberg's concept of multidirectional memory, which suggests that cultural memory is a sphere in which different communities interact and share memories. Rothberg argues this partly in order to undercut the idea that certain memories exclusively belong to certain social groups, and vice versa, that certain groups are exclusively defined by certain memories. So Rothberg is coming out of Holocaust history, and he's arguing that the Jews as a social group do not own Holocaust history, and vice versa, that Jews as a social group are not defined purely by the Holocaust. So he is arguing that it is particularly important in remembering and commemorating violent pasts. He says that we need to acknowledge our implication in each other's suffering and loss, and to begin to imagine a more equitable future in which such violence might be minimized through an acknowledgement of our common humanity, grounded by the awareness of our mutual experience of histories of destruction. So that in doing this, trying to create and acknowledging where it already exists, a multi-directional memory, you create, or a transcultural memory, you know, a memory of other cultural groups that might be relevant to us, we can create a kind of social solidarity via memory. And I think that this is one of those ways of moving in what Lauren Berlant argues is the necessity of moving from feeling, right? We are feeling in response to something, to social change. I share Rothberg's ambition for a progressive and ethical memory culture that might perform or enact compassionate solidarity and thus enable us to move from feeling to social change. And yet I am quite pessimistic about this happening, because it depends on so much more than cultural expressions. It depends on the market actually changing. How does the market affect commemoration? The Abbey is not only the most well-funded arts organisation in the country, but it received an extra €500,000 from the Department of Culture, Arts and the Gaeltacht, whatever way order that is in, for its 2016 programme. Yet the director, Fig McAneill, contends that there is no money in the budget for women. As Fintan O'Toole argued in November, if we ask how we got to the point where the National Theatre didn't notice that its nation was made up almost entirely of people with penises, we must, of course, look at the deep roots of male privilege and female marginalisation. But we also have to look at rather more boring and mundane things, sloppy governance in the arts. Why did the Minister for Arts, Heather Humphreys, and her officials give the Abbey €500,000 for waking the nation without noticing that the programme had a fundamental problem? While memory might not be a finite resource, money is, particularly with the arts budget the way it's been cut back in recent years. And so commemorative events, before they are even launched, are in competition for funding and support. Post-launch events are in competition for attention, whether that's space in the media or space in the audience's calendar. Gender is actually a helpful factor in advertising and thus increasing audience attention. From an exclusive focus on women's history, which will bring a particular kind of audience to Richmond Barracks, for instance, to different and, I think, slightly objectionable reconstructions of Irish history along other lines. This is the Rubber Bandits Guide to 1916, which chooses to illustrate the history of 1916 with women wearing bikinis and balaclavas. Yay. Okay. When certain events are given more powerful platforms, then it's likely that they will also attain a greater market share of audience attention. And without audience attention, since commemoration is a performance, without us as the audience to that performance making the past present, these memories remain simply past. So when the National Theatre puts together a male-dominated programme representing not just a male-dominated history but a male-dominated present, then obviously that's a problem. And a problem that, I suggest, the market, with its recognition that segmentation actually creates profit, is not rushing to change.
Okay, so when I was asked to talk, first of all, thanks to Una for organising today, and particularly for asking me to participate. So I'm most definitely not a historian. I'm kind of approaching this, I suppose, both as an academic, but also as an activist, as someone who's involved in campaigning for abortion rights in Ireland. And when I think about this sort of decade of commemoration, I suppose I've always thought about it as a moment not to look back, but as a moment to focus on the present, as a moment in which we can interrogate the present moment. And I suppose that's what I want to do here with my time, is to look at the Irish state. If we think about the decade of commemoration as a moment that explores and celebrates the origins and birth of the Irish state, I want to, I suppose, ask the question, what image of the Irish state emerges if it's considered from the perspective of women? But I particularly want to look at it in terms of the perspective of the female body, because so much of the history of the Irish state and in terms of how the Irish state has kind of crafted and formulated a particular identity for itself has involved the regulation and control of female sexuality and the female body. And I suppose that question of asking, of using 1916 as a moment to ask a question about the present is something that the first one that came to mind was an editorial back in 2010, which was a kind of very famous editorial of the 18th of November,
day following the bailout, the European bailout, in which the Irish Times very famously had that editorial. The headline, was it for this? And the first lines asked the question, was it for this, European bailout that the men of, essentially the men of 1916 went out and fought and died for? And I think we can ask a similar question in terms of what has emerged in the last 100 years in terms of the Irish state, and particularly a state that has done so much damage, inflicted so much abuse on the bodies and lives of Irish women. So I think 1916, I would argue, is a very good place to begin to look at that history. Now, obviously, in the course of, particularly in the last 2 decades or so, there has been some attempt, I think, to look backwards. Particularly, for example, I'm thinking in terms of Irish film, there's been a number of kind of quite popular films like Philomena or The Magdalen Sisters that have given very sort of powerful accounts of what happened to women who were incarcerated in the Magdalen laundries, women who were in mother and baby homes and forced to give up their children. But I think often how that's understood, or certainly how they're marketed or presented, these films, are often a kind of a sense of what Joe Cleary has called a negative validation of the present. This sort of idea of now, and this was, I think, particularly common in the late 1990s and early 2000s, when we were in the kind of grips of the so-called Celtic Tiger. And looking back became a way almost of saying, look how far we've come, look how wonderful we are now. We can look back to that horrific past, but locate it very firmly in the past, arguing that there's the implication being that there's a very deep separation between the past and the present. Ignoring, of course, the fact that women who were in these mother and baby homes, who had their children adopted against their will, are still fighting for justice. The women who were incarcerated in Magdalen laundries may have gotten their apology, but the state continue to fight them in terms of compensation. Just last week they learned that the medical card that they had been promised by the Irish state is actually not going to be the full medical card that they were initially promised. So the struggles for justice continue very much into the present, even though in terms of, I think, the kind of public narrative, and certainly the version, the official narrative of the state and the government, which likes to locate them very firmly in the past. So I think if we think of 1916, as Roisin talked about, the sort of the kind of three pillars of it as a nationalist struggle, but also a socialist struggle and a feminist struggle. That in many ways a lot remains unfinished in terms of struggle, the labour struggles, but particularly in terms of feminist struggles. So, you know, the very famous proclamation of the Irish Republic, read in 1916, famously says that the Irish Republic is entitled to and hereby claims the allegiance of every Irish man and Irish woman, including both genders. The Republic guarantees religious and civil liberty, equal rights and equal opportunities to all its citizens, and declares its resolve to pursue the happiness and prosperity of the whole nation and of all its parts, cherishing all of the children of the nation equally and oblivious of the differences carefully fostered by an alien government which have divided a minority from the majority of the past. And if we think of 1916 as a moment in which this ideal is gone out and fought for, and it for some would argue has been achieved in the establishment of the Irish Free State in 1922, and very much part of the kind of, I think, official commemoration is a moment of celebration, that this is what we're supposed to celebrate. But if you look particularly over the last 6-7 years of imposed austerity, I think if you began to sort of interrogate that at all different levels, even that sort of just that very idea of challenge of cherishing all of the children equally. We know that Ireland has one of the highest levels of child poverty in the European Union. If you just take that statement and actually begin to kind of work through, you would see in many ways there's actually very little to kind of celebrate in terms of creating a more equal society. In Ireland, as indeed globally, as the report came out yesterday from Oxfam, we've seen that the world, the state Ireland, the state we're living in, but also more globally, we're seeing levels of entrenched inequality that you actually haven't seen since the late 19th century. Now, obviously, that's not just a national question, that's also a global question. But I want to just use my remaining time to talk particularly to focus on the question of women. So when we following the establishment of the Free State in 1922, in terms of what Mary has talked about between the 1922 Constitution and the 1937 Constitution. There is a very determined agenda at play that is about pushing women to the margins. And during that period, and indeed in the decades that follow it, one of the distinguishing marks of Irish identity becomes we see women's reproductive sexuality becoming key to that. Culminating in the 1937 Constitution that constructs women as mothers and childbearers located in the private home in Article 41(2) of the Irish Constitution. So women's dedication to reproducing the next generation of Irish people becomes elevated as a symbol of Ireland's moral and cultural distinctiveness, as a way of defining Irish identity in opposition to its former colonial master, Britain. And I think that identity, that sort of symbolism of women as wives and mothers located in the domestic sphere, leads to the direct regulation of women's sexuality, not only in terms of channeling that into childbearing within marriage, but in terms of banning contraception and the banning of abortion. So much so that I think women live in what the visual artists Sarah Brown and Jesse Jones have termed in the shadow of the state, which I think is this is part of a project that they're doing, funded by the Arts Council, in which they're looking at the shadows, looking at women's experience, particularly in terms of the female body. Brown and Jones' work ask, how did the female body become the focus of repressed histories and political desires under the regulation of the Irish state? This is a work that's going to be in a series of kind of public installations done over the coming years. And this is one of the images that they're using. This is a photograph of a cabin inside a ferry to across to Holyhead, symbolising the journey that women take, or at least before the evolution of Ryanair, this is how the vast majority of women would have travelled to Britain to access an abortion following the legalisation of abortion in Britain in 1967. So that idea of travel is of leaving the Irish state is in many ways the kind of the woman as exile. Women who do not conform to that notion of a wife and a mother, in many ways were either completely marginalised or forced into exile, excluded from a particular version of the Irish state. Breda Gray and Louise Ryan have suggested that in their desire to create a new imagined community within the boundaries of the 26 county state, Church and state fashioned a seamlessly homogenous society that closed off internal challenges and contradictions, even as they represent society as pure and untainted by external corruption. So what we see is that women who do not conform are forced to the margins or into the shadows and forced into exile. And again, what I want to argue is that that exile, that marginalization, I think, continues for women today, particularly in terms of reproductive rights for women. Every day in this state, 11 women will leave this country today to travel abroad to access an abortion. The Irish state in 1983 inserts the following amendment into the constitution following a bitterly contested referendum campaign referred to by the Irish Times as the second partitioning of Ireland. The state acknowledges the right to life of the unborn and with due regard to the equal right to life of the mother, guarantees in its laws to respect and as far as practical by its laws to defend and vindicate that right. So this is Article 43.3 of the Irish Constitution, known as the Eighth Amendment. It is amended in 1992 following the X case. This was the case involving the 14-year-old rape victim who was denied the right to, the Attorney General Harry Whelan, she was a 14-year-old who had been raped, was taken abroad by her parents to access an abortion in Britain. The then Attorney General Harry Whelan placed an injunction on her and recalled her family back to Ireland. The injunction was made permanent or was extended to an 11-month period by the High Court and that neither she nor her parents were permitted for a period of 11 months to leave the Irish jurisdiction. Famously, this is the front page of the Irish Times in a couple of days after that when the story broke in the very famous Martin Turner cartoon, the introduction of internment in Ireland for 14-year-old girls, the reference, of course, being to the policy of internment in the north. I should just add, I don't have time to go into it, but this is an all-Ireland perspective as well. And it is interesting in terms of thinking about thinking about Ireland not as a 26 county, but thinking about the 32 counties, that abortion is also illegal in the north, with the 67 Act never being extended to the north of Ireland. And indeed, we've just seen last week the second prosecution in less than 6 months of a woman who attempted to access abortion pills via the internet. So abortion is criminalised both in the north and in the south. In the south, you face up to 14 years 14 years in prison. In the north, under the 1861 Act, you face a life sentence of penal servitude for having an illegal abortion. It is if you think about the history, it's probably one of the few points of agreement that you could probably locate between both nationalist and unionist politicians in terms of the history of the Northern Ireland conflict. Almost all of the mainstream Northern Irish political parties are in full agreement that the 67 Act should not be extended to Northern Ireland. So this Eighth Amendment, these 42 words, essentially equate the life of a pregnant woman with that of a fetus. Following the X case in 1992, this is amended slightly to include the fact that a woman has a constitutional right, abortion is illegal in Ireland, but you have a constitutional right to travel abroad for an abortion. So in other words, we don't care what you do once you leave the state. You can go and have an abortion as long as it's not within the Irish state. And you have the right to information about abortion, and I think obviously enshrined in this is the level. I mean, is the hypocrisy of it at so many levels. Not least the fact that you have a constitutional right to go somewhere else for an abortion, but you can't have one here. I mean, it's just the hypocrisy is breathtaking. But also in terms of this kind of structuring of as I was talking about in terms of Irish Irish identity and it being kind of woven into the idea of female, the regulation and control of female sexuality. I think there's a particular identity that, that emerges, and I think that that came into very, very obvious view in the very late 1990s and early 2000s around the citizenship referendum. Because the image of Irish identity that is constructed through female sexuality in terms of the Irish Constitution, it quickly emerges is a Catholic one, certainly, but is very much an image of Irish identity that is associated with whiteness as well. And I just want to just look at that very briefly for a moment, because there's two cases I think that most clearly identify that, and that is the Baby O case, which was a case that was taken in 2001 by a Nigerian woman who was facing deportation. She was pregnant at the time, and she appealed to the High Court and later to the Supreme Court to prevent her deportation on the grounds that she was pregnant and that the Eighth Amendment offered her a level of protection. This was vehemently opposed by the Irish state, that began first of all by arguing that the fetus was not a person, but there had been a whole history of court cases from the X case, the C case, the D case, several cases in which not only did the state argue that the fetus was a person, in fact, and this continues right up until the most recent case last year in December 2013, in which the fetus is entitled to its own independent legal representation. So in these cases, not only is the fetus, do they argue that the fetus is an independent entity, it actually gets its own barrister to defend its interests in these court cases. So the court, the Irish Attorney General began first by arguing that it wasn't a person. Then this was clearly not getting them very far. So then they very, very quickly changed tactics and began to argue that it was different in this particular case. That when you wanted to deport someone, it was very different. And the essential argument that they made was, well, if you prevent this deportation, well, then you'll never be able to deport another woman of childbearing years, because the argument that Ms. O was making was that healthcare and maternal death, child mortality rates in Nigeria were much higher than Ireland, and that her fetus and later her child would be at risk if she was deported. The Supreme Court ruled in favour of the state, unsurprisingly, and it said if the state's, Supreme Court ruling, which says if the state's right to deport persons who have been refused refugee status and who have no legal right to remain in this country were thus circumscribed, it would be in a great range of cases virtually negated. In other words, agreeing with the government's argument. And it is obvious that the rights of the unborn in this context cannot be less than those of the unborn. So the right to life, the right to deport, should I say, trumps the right to life in these particular cases. And the question of women's reproductive capacity also is used again in the following year during the 2002 citizenship referendum, where the sort of spectacle of the sort of horror show of pregnant women from all parts of the globe coming to Ireland to give birth to access Ireland's apparently generous citizenship rights, even though the idea of citizenship being rooted in where you're born is not unusual in lots of countries. In the United States, for example, if you're born in the United States, you're a United States citizen. This is the sort of the idea of women's fertility is used was used in the referendum as a kind of as this sort of threatening and polluting force. And again, of course, the question that is at play here that was not of course stated at the time is the question of race. That what the sort of unspoken anxiety here is not of Irish women having too many babies and the maternity services being overrun, but of non-Irish babies being born in these hospitals. Again, creating this very, very narrow sense of what is Irish identity. And is, you know, so that during the referendum campaign, the masters of the maternity hospitals are rolled out to support the 2002 citizenship referendum, which is about denying rights to children of migrant parents. So again, women's reproductive rights being used, or reproductive capacity being used in terms of the creation of a very specific and a narrow notion of Irish identity. Again, just very, very quickly, this is an image. This is from the Miss Y case. This is August 2013. This was the first woman, or one of the first women, to access an abortion under the PLDPA, the Protection of Life During Pregnancy Bill that had been introduced to allow abortion in terms where a woman's life was at risk, including the risk of suicide. This involved a woman from Africa who had been raped in her home country, coming to Ireland, discovering that she was pregnant only on her arrival here, and trying to access an abortion that was deemed by doctors and the apparatus around the PLDPA that she was legally entitled to. The doctors, and there's an ongoing, it's not quite clear what actually happened because there's an ongoing investigation, but she was denied an abortion and forced against her will, essentially, to have a cesarean section at 22 weeks. This is an image from the pro-life campaign. They decided to adopt her baby and name it Baby Hope and covered the city in these images. Now, we know very little about this woman. Obviously, she has a right to anonymity, but we do know that she was from Africa and she was escaping civil war. So more likely than not, her baby was not the whitest, pinkest baby that they could possibly find, but it is, the baby skin would have been considerably darker. But in all of the iconography, and there's a whole series of iconography if you just Google it, around Baby Hope, this is the image that you see. Again, and this sort of idea of kind of fetal citizenship, if you like, is very is a kind of key iconography that the anti-choice, anti-abortion movement uses, learning, of course, its lessons kind of from North America. Just very, very quickly, I just want to just finally talk about a way of maybe some of the ways that abortion rights activists have chosen to challenge this. And I want to look at the work of a performance-based group called Speaking of Imelda. They are a group of activists located in Britain, many of whom are of Irish descent. They have Irish parents or grandparents. And they got together about 2 years ago to start this performance-based group called Speaking of Imelda. Imelda is the name, it was a code word that was used by the Abortion Support Network in London in the late 1970s and early 1980s to assist women who were travelling from Ireland to London and other cities to access an abortion. The women would meet Irish women off the boat or off the train in London. They would wear red to identify themselves, and the code word that they used was Imelda. They've changed this into the acronym Ireland, Making England the Legal Destination for Abortion, and they've engaged in a series of very provocative forms of activism. They started off with a campaign called Knickers for Choice, in which they invited women to buy knickers and to write pro-choice slogans, repeal the Eighth Amendment, to photograph them and put them on Twitter. They also, over Christmas in 2013, they filmed themselves and photographed themselves going around various Irish state offices, using knickers to polish the brass. And then they would photograph them with the knickers that had pro-choice slogans on them. They also, at a fundraising dinner that Fine Gael organised just outside London, in which Enda Kenny was the guest speaker for the London Irish community, they interrupted the dinner, brought in on a silver platter a pair of knickers that were placed in front of Enda, and very quickly one of his aides came to spare his blushes and put a napkin so that poor Enda wouldn't be embarrassed, and they were chanting solidarity with the 11 women who travel every day. But this one is one that was done last Easter Monday outside the GPO, in which they rewrote the proclamation using pro-choice lyrics. And I'm just going to show about 30 seconds of it and then I'll stop. But I just think it's a kind of interesting way of kind of thinking about commemoration. So this is done as part, there's an official commemoration happening in O'Connell Street, and this is part of the unofficial commemoration. So the women have chained, they're wearing red, and they've chained themselves to the GPO. Directly referencing the proclamation and the idea not just of citizenship rights, but of ownership not only of the nation state, of the country, but ownership, the women's ownership of their own bodies is directly referenced in this. And I think it's a kind of really interesting and kind of very provocative way of using and challenging the kind of official notions of commemoration and using that in terms of advancing the struggles for women's rights today.